Good evening. Welcome to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Tuesday. Coming up in the second hour of the show, we will be joined by a really good friend of WEAA and First Edition, Dr. Courtney Alston. The happy researcher will be with us during our Black Girl Magic segment. Can't wait for that conversation. We will be joined by another really great guest. That is the Black Mental Health Alliance, Dr. Lakeisha Carter, as well as Jan Desper-Peters, the executive director of the Black Mental Health Alliance, will be with us as well, talking about depression, something that affects millions of people around this country every single day. So those two important conversations coming in the second hour of the show. A little bit later in this first hour, there was a rally and a meet connected to a meeting at the Baltimore City Council as the council continued to debate over this mandatory minimum gun law that the city is trying to impose. There were clashes between protesters and police during that meeting. We will talk to Nicole Mundell, of Director of Out for Justice, as well as Lawrence Grand Prix, Director of Research for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. We invited Eric Costello, who is one of the main proponents of this proposed law. We have not heard back from his office yet. So that's coming up a little bit later in this first hour. But first, a report on the 108th National NAACP Convention. In a minute, we'll go to a package or some sound that was given to us by Mikkel Hunter, WEA host and reporter. WEA host of the Baltimore Blend, Mikkel Hunter. But first, we go to my colleague, Alexis Taylor, reporter for the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper. Alexis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Sean. How are you?
I'm feeling pretty good. I'm feeling all right. Glad that you are able to report for us from the convention. You've been covering it since last week. Give me, before we get into the specifics, Alexis, kind of your overall take of what you've seen, what you've witnessed.
Well, I would say that what I've seen, it's showing that the NAACP is still here and it is still one of those organizations. It is still the premier organization for the advancement of African Americans in this country. And their way of doing it is through their public policy, pushing their legislative agenda, pushing these issues in front of our senators, in front of our congressmen, and getting bills passed that will make us move forward, get equity on some important issues.
Of course. The organization remains prominent in the areas of civil rights, obviously. But the some of the headliners, if you will, that spoke talked about issues that are incredibly important issues facing the Black community, many of them centered on law enforcement reform, in particular mass incarceration, and the bail review system, as a matter of fact.
Right.
Kamala Harris, the Senator of California, former Attorney General of that state, spoke about mass incarceration, I believe.
Yes. So let me tell you, Sean, I really feel like one thing that needs to be said is that women really are out there and they're really pushing to make change. So you did have Senator Kamala Harris from California, and her cry was for bail reform.
Okay.
And she said that it's injustice, and it is. It's an injustice that two people who are arrested, they go to jail for the exact same thing, the exact same offense. And the person who has money to pay bail, they get out. But the person who doesn't have the money, they sit in jail. And as a result, so many things, there are so many consequences as a result of them not having the money. It's not about public safety. It's about the money. And so she and several other senators voiced their opinion about bail reform and also about reform with the practice of using private prisons. The way we have companies taking advantage of prisoners while they're in prison, shipped away. Senator Tammy Duckworth talked about the phone companies that are still taking advantage of prisoners while they're locked up, and they're paying $15 for a phone call when that's their only way to reach family. So bail reform and reform within the use of private prisons to, you know, house these inmates. They also talked a lot about the environmental injustice that we're seeing in communities of color, people who are in low-income communities. And it's not just happening in Flint. You know, across the country, we have these plants. We have chemical plants. We have things being dumped into streams that are, you know, being used by communities of color and, you know, Americans in general. Everyone should be concerned about this. It's just, you know, across the board, the NAACP held different sessions, you know, and they were very informative on issues that are affecting the African-American community and where we fit in changing that.
Baltimore City State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby also spoke about mass incarceration specifically during one of her sessions. Talk about the atmosphere during that. I mean, obviously, mass incarceration. You mentioned the bail review system, which Baltimore has kind of been in the forefront of trying to reform that system against much resistance from the bail industry. But also mass incarceration, obviously, is a firestorm conversation in many arenas. And Marilyn Mosby was right in the middle of one of those conversations here at the convention.
Yes. So Marilyn Mosby and State's Attorney Aramis Ayala, they both received the Champions of Justice Award from the NAACP. And so the atmosphere in the room, I mean, they both were welcomed with a standing ovation in both of their speeches. And so I think that it was well-deserved. They were welcomed warmly, and people were really just in the spirit of everything that Marilyn Mosby has stood for as far as mass incarceration. Not only that, but like I said, a state's attorney, Ayala spoke about how we need to change the law on the death penalty. And so both of these women were both welcome, you know, really warmly. They came and went to a standing ovation.
And finally, Alexis, your observations on the appearance of former attorney, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder.
Former state's attorney Eric Holder, he was welcomed warmly as well. He spoke mainly about the changes that need to happen as far as voting laws. He talked about the sweeping changes that have happened in restricting people from voting instead of helping them vote easier. He called out states such as Texas that made it harder for college students to vote, where, you know, in that state, they'll take a license to carry a gun, but they won't take a card that says, you know, I'm a student here in the state of Texas. You know, I'm paying tuition. I'm here. This is where I'm living. You know, so he talked about just how we're seeing steps taken to move us backwards instead of forwards as far as voting. One thing that he said he wanted to see across the country was the automatic registration of voters. Why are states that previously registered all high school students taking a step backwards and getting rid of those initiatives? So he wants to see automatic voter registration. And like you said, healthcare, just like voting and all of these other things, these are human rights. You know, you have a right to vote. You have a right to say what's going on, not only locally, but on a national level as well. And so it needs to be automatic. You're a citizen here, you get to vote. And it should be easy. It should be easier, not harder.
Well, absolutely true. And that is at the core of this battle for voting rights in the United States. Alexis Taylor is a reporter for the Afro newspaper, Baltimore Afro American newspaper. Alexis, I thank you for your time and your report. We appreciate you.
Thank you.
We are going to make the transition to former Baltimore City Delegate Jill Carter. She's the director of the Baltimore Civil Rights Commission. Director Carter, welcome back to First Edition.
Hi, Sean. It's nice to be on the show again.
Yes, it's nice. It's always nice to have you. What's the full? Give me the full name of your commission, Jill.
You mean the panel? Okay. My office is the Baltimore City Office of Civil Rights and Wage Enforcement.
Got it.
But I'm good with civil rights because I think everything falls under civil rights, including fair wages.
Then I will stick with the Civil Rights Commission, Director Jill Carter. You were also a featured speaker at the 108th National NAACP Convention. Talk about what was at stake in your mind, or what is at stake? What is the NAACP and Black people in this country? What are we facing right now in 2017? I mean, with the 45th president of the United States and all the other challenges that Baltimore specifically are facing, Jill?
We're really at a very, very critical point, and I'll tell you why. At the beginning of it, so I just finished being on a panel about pathways to police accountability and civilian oversight. And so it was discussed about where the state of civilian oversight is in every state in the country. And some states and some cities, some local jurisdictions are doing better than Baltimore is, and some are not even anywhere close to where we are in terms of even having a semblance of a civilian oversight board or civilian review board. But one of the things that I found really interesting is that there still appeared to be kind of, in my opinion, a spirit of almost helplessness when we discuss these very issues we've been discussing in Baltimore for so long and in Maryland about how we get around that there's law enforcement officers, Bill of Rights, you know, some different names that are everywhere. There's the police contracts. And so I think one of the things that resonated with me throughout the entire panel discussion is that when are we going to realize the power that we have? And so at the beginning of the panel, the moderator, who was Barbara Arnwine, she said that a survey had been taken by the NAACP and that 95% of all Black people in the country believe that there should be police reform. Now, if that is in fact true, then the question must be, what percentage of those 95% are voters that give their votes locally and on a state level to different elected officials, different legislators, and townspeople who aren't pushing that agenda? And so if one thing that resonated for me in the panel is that this is a group of very committed people from all over this country. Some of them were local branch managers, many of them were, that all, you know, that there was power in the room, expressed an interest in strengthening their civilian review board. And of course, here in Baltimore, we have a long way to go, and I have a vision for where we should go. But what was interesting is that there were many, many people from other areas, like horrible Oklahoma, which is just dreadful, you know, looking to us and me for direction into how they can even get where we are.
Interesting. Talk a little bit, Jill, about the vision that you have for your office, the Civil Rights Commission in Baltimore City.
So the vision, of course, when it comes to the Civilian Review Board, you know, most people know and have been following the fact that the consent decree called for the Civilian Oversight Task Force, and the Civilian Oversight Task Force is charged with one responsibility. And I say that because I keep hearing dialogue about what they can do. No, the consent decree gives them one responsibility, and that is to review the operations of the Civilian Review Board and make recommendations for how to make it more effective. And so what I'm hoping and intend to work very diligently with them on is to create that. And so it is not possible that we can have an effective civilian review board without legislative changes and increased financial resources. And so those, to me, ought to be the two most fundamental things. And you already know, and many people know, some of the legislative changes. But basically, we are the only entity that has the statutory authority to, one, review actions of police when it comes to allegations of misconduct and make recommendations, and two, the authority to review policies and practices of the department and make recommendations. So the good news is we have some authority. The bad news is that we're limited to recommendations, and I believe the push must be for ultimate decision-making authority on some of these issues. So that's my vision, that we actually move from a civilian review board to what the task force is called, which is a civilian oversight board, and then also that because of that authority, that statutory authority to review policies and practices, that we would not remain limited to these five areas of misconduct allegations, but that we wouldn't only do things, make recommendations on the back end after misconduct has occurred, but that we would review things at the front end, including policing strategies, policing policies, and even budgetary decisions.
Well, that is quite a ambitious vision, and and I'm hopeful that you are able, that you will be able to implement it. If anybody can, you can.
Well, you know, not me, because I think the people of Baltimore stood up and spoke about the need for change some years ago
absolutely.
In the wake of Freddie Gray.
Absolutely.
And they have to continue to make this push. Having a consent decree, having me on the head of the Civilian Review Board, having a Civilian Oversight Task Force, those things are not enough. It's everything is still people-driven, and people have to be at the center of pushing it.
Jill Carter is the director of Baltimore City Civil Rights Commission. Jill, it's always a pleasure, and you have an open-door policy here. Anytime you want to be on,
thank you, Sean. Appreciate you. Thank you.
We appreciate you. All right. We're going to go to a report by WEAA's Mikkel Hunter next. Mikkel?
Sean, thank you so very much for having me back on First Edition, as I've been reporting live all week from the 108th NAACP Annual Convention. The NAACP is the country's oldest and largest civil rights organization, and those civil rights leaders were there this morning for the 2017 resolution session. Educator, former NAACP CEO and President Kwaisi Mfume spoke, and also Jesse Jackson, William Barber, had the crowd standing on their feet shouting, "We shall not be moved." Let's join some of that conversation from Kwaisi Mfume and Jesse Jackson.
I'm happy to bring you greetings as a Baltimorean for all of you who have come here to Baltimore, and to bring you greetings on behalf of our NAACP. We're at the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. We believe that colored people come in all colors. This morning, if you will indulge me for just a moment, I want to say a couple of things about our history, our social justice system, our education, and our economic challenge, and then get out of the way so that Reverend Barber and others can come forward. In this fast-moving age of reality TV, social media and fake news, and the ultimate put-down question of what have you done for me lately, never let us forget, as Reverend said a moment ago, that bridge that got us across. Never let us forget the nameless and faceless black people who didn't have college degrees, who couldn't speak the King's English, whose brows were wrinkled and whose backs were bent, but who found a way on plantations all over this country to lay down in their time and in their way to make their bodies bridges that we might run across and get to this century and be here today as the people who we are. Though it may be tattered and torn, it is our ship, it is our NAACP, it is our bridge. And we know that people who refuse to teach and cherish their history are bound to repeat it.
That was former president of the NAACP and former representative from the 7th Congressional District of Baltimore City, Kwaisi Mfume. Next up, legendary civil rights advocate, Reverend Jesse Jackson.
I'm trying to sum up this point. We repeat, say we live in our faith and culture. We live under the law. We live in faith and culture. We live under the law. What was especially cruel about slavery was it was legal. What was especially cruel about the Rosa Parks crisis, she got on the bus, it was not just a driver who did his job. There was a sign above the driver's head that read, "Colored seat from the rear, white seat from the law, from the back by state law. If violate, you're prohibited, you'll go to jail," the law. 64, we went to jail trying to use a public library. It was the law. NAA has led the fight for just law. We come out of slavery after 246 years of slavery. Of all the things we fight for, if I had a one item of agenda, it is to say fight for the protected right to vote. Voter fraud is a fraud. Consumer fraud is real. Voter fraud is fake news. We're going to fight for the protected right to vote. Why must we put so much focus on this voting rights issue, Brother Russell? Because you can focus on health, housing, health and human services, but that's about the vote.
Now back to First Edition with Sean Yost. I'm Mitchell Hunter for WEAA 88.9, live at the 108th annual NAACP convention.
Mikkel Hunter of the Baltimore Blend. Thank you so much, Mikkel, for your reporting this week. Also want to thank Afro reporter Alexis Taylor for her report that we got a little bit earlier. And of course, Joe Carter, director of the Baltimore City Office of Civil Rights Commission. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about this meeting that took place down in Baltimore City Council discussing a proposed mandatory minimum sentence for a gun law for the city. There were clashes between police and protesters. We'll talk to two of the groups that are protesting this proposed law. That is Nicole Mundell of Out for Justice, as well as Lawrence Grand Prix of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Stay tuned. You are listening to First Edition. Back to First Edition here on EAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yeo, your host, making the transition from the 108th National Convention of the NAACP to legislation here in Baltimore, proposed legislation here in Baltimore that would create a mandatory minimum for possession of a handgun in the city in certain areas. Two groups opposed to, among many who were opposed to this mandatory minimum, rallied today at City Hall. In the studio with me is Nicole Mundell. She's director of Out for Justice. Nicole, welcome to First Edition.
Thank you for having me.
And also in the studio is Brother Lawrence Grand Prix. He's director of research of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Lawrence, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I reached out directly to Eric Costello's office. He is, I suspect it's fair to characterize him as the main proponent of this legislation, this proposed one-year mandatory minimum. His office did not get back in time. I invited him to be on the show. They didn't respond to my phone call. Again, the invitation was sent. One of my reporters from the Afro, Jennifer Wright, was also at the rally and sent back video of police clashing with protesters, and her observation was that those police were ordered to arrest those protesters by none other than Councilman Eric Costello. Is that accurate from y'all's perspective? Y'all were there.
I did not witness him ordering them to arrest the protesters. Yeah. However, I don't think, it could be true because in the very beginning of the hearing, you know, for me, he was very aggressive about banging his gavel and, you know, saying, you know, if folks become out of line, I will put you out, you know, stuff like that. So,
he was the one calling the meeting, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
One of the things that Jennifer said to me was that initially only people who were pro this legislation were able to speak. Is that accurate?
From what I saw, because I actually was teaching a youth program at the time, but I was watching as much on the live stream as I could. That was a courtesy, obviously, to the elected officials who were speaking, so they got to go first. And then after the elected officials, who were mixed, obviously, there was a string of people who testified in favor of the bill. Obviously, you know, potentially it is Mr. Costello's committee, so he has a certain ability to control the list in that respect. And usually the community folks testify last. Mm-hmm. And because there was such an extensive list of community folks, an extensive list of lawmakers, including state lawmakers testifying, I think that produced a lot of frustration in the crowd that bubbled over. And it was Mr. Costello's response to say that he felt that people were being rowdy in a way that he felt justified, and I think what Nicole described in the media as a militarized response, which is to default to policing in that situation.
Nicole, I saw in one of the live streams, one of the Afro live streams from the rally prior to the meeting, you make the suggestion that it was on purpose that this meeting was called, this council mm-hmm. meeting was called at 10 o'clock in the morning when people work. I mean, I work. We all work.
Yeah.
And for the council to call that meeting at that time, in your at least from your perspective, was on purpose and was an obstacle to people like your you and your organization.
Yeah. And it's common practice. It's done on a state level, and it was definitely done today. I mean, if Councilman Costello truly wanted to hear from the masses of community folks who were opposed to this legislation, he would have figured out a way to make it convenient for the citizens of Baltimore to attend. So it was definitely deliberate, in my opinion.
Lawrence Grand Prix, I did not get to read because I was in the midst of a bunch of things, but I did not get to read specifically the report that said that the city members of the city council had worked on watering down, for lack of a better term, the proposed gun legislation. What can you tell us about that?
Well, one of the very first things that was proposed was an amendment by Councilman John Bullock. John Bullock was the swing vote. So there were lots of folks working the phones, pressuring lawmakers, and we got a vote count. And basically, it was split right down the middle. And the one person who was on the pro side, who didn't feel like typically would be on the pro side, is John Bullock. And the suspicion is that it was really a political, a fear of retaliation. Potentially, he had promised his vote to
Costello.
Not necessarily Costello, but to Jack Young.
Oh, okay.
And so he was like, people are afraid of political repercussions when you cross the chair of the committee, or in this case, the chair of the city council. And so, as someone who's known John Bullock for literally years, people were confused why he was in favor of this legislation, and it was potentially fear of retaliation. So the first thing he did was propose an amendment, which took it from a first offense, this triggers a mandatory minimum, to a second offense. And in the context of using the gun, was in the context of a violent crime, commission of a violent act. So basically, the amendment that came out, and it was voted favorably, basically makes this bill the status quo. It doesn't really have a huge change now that this amendment has been passed. And the fact that they kept debating it, the fact that they kept talking about it like it was the same bill, leads me to believe that this amendment came from a fear that this was a political hot button issue, which clearly it was. And they were trying to soften the blow, but they're not ready to relinquish the public relations value of being in the media talking about this issue as if they're actually doing something. They're not doing anything substantive that much anymore because of this amendment. But they want the PR value of continuing to talk about it. And I think that's really disingenuous and somewhat disrespectful to the citizens of Baltimore. It's like, we know when something's getting passed just for the sake of saying we passed something. And to a substantial extent, that's what this is now because of this amendment. If they keep talking about it, they should withdraw it because it's the status quo. But if they keep talking about it like it's a real thing, they're only doing it because they want to say they did something.
Well, there's a couple of things. Number one, as we've been reporting on the effort to pass this bill, there's state law that already does exactly what this law is allegedly supposed to be doing. So there seemed like an inherent conflict on that level. There may have been constitutional conflicts as well and other conflicts connected to the proposed this proposed gun law. But I think the even broader reality, and I think in some ways more disturbing, Nicole, is it seemed like, and I wrote about this in my column, we talked about it on the show, this seemed like simply a knee-jerk reaction, a response to a third year of record violence in our city, record homicides in our city, and a knee-jerk reaction is not a adequate substitute for clear and cogent policy. I think that's a fair statement.
Right. I mean, because instead of doing the real work of investing in community organizations and figuring out preventative measures and how they could utilize community folks who are on the ground communicating with some of these individuals who they think may have guns, and instead of, you know, providing resources to them to then go inside the communities, talk to community members, really figure out what the problem is and deal with the root cause of it, you know, it was just... It was lazy, quite frankly. So let's just figure something out. Let's keep some of these seasoned folk in our community. Let's just hush them up, because, you know, they are calling, they're complaining about the violence, and these are the individuals who most likely vote for us. These are our seasoned voters, you know. And so let's figure out a way to keep them quiet and, you know, all the while sabotaging the larger community.
Well, that has been the strategy of individuals as far as proponents of law enforcement or a militarized version of law enforcement in our city for many years. Strike fear in the hearts of older citizens of our city, and get their responses. Do you want more police or less police? I mean, a simplistic kind of proposal is put out to them, and of course the reaction, especially from older residents of Baltimore, is of course we want more police, and that is a suggestion in the minds of some that means more money for law enforcement, $17 million more this past session, this past budget. Lawrence Grand Prix, how much longer is the city of Baltimore going to continue to invest millions of dollars in a law enforcement apparatus that doesn't seem to be functioning needs to be?
One of the things that I think is potentially useful from Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, is that it is a failure to see the criminal justice system as a failure. It is working the way it was designed to work. We as a society have chosen to make an investment in the incarceration and punishment of poor black individuals, specifically poor black men. And now we are reaping the return on our investment. Because it's not that the system is failing. It's producing exactly what it's designed to produce. You take young communities. You withdraw young men who are trying to provide for their families, young men who are caught in a cycle of violence, young men who may be carrying a gun. And then you have individuals who have huge family instability. If you've ever experienced a SWAT team raid, you understand how traumatic that event can be. And so you have these ripples of trauma going through the community, but specifically you have individuals who go to jail at a young age and they come back hard. They come back hardened. They come back traumatized. They come back ready to kill. These are the individuals who are causing the murders on our streets. And this bill would produce more of those individuals. We keep doing the same thing over and over again. And that's really, I think, the definition of insanity. But it shows the complete failure of imagination when it comes to thinking of black men as human beings and truly believing that if you invest in creating alternatives to them, that they would pursue those alternatives. That thought is so anathema to folks like the Greater Baltimore Committee, who actually produced a report that supported this proposal. And that those type of entities have a vision of justice that is so narrow. Get the crime rate under control so we can get more businesses. Do whatever you can to keep the crime rate under 300, because that affects the image of the city. We have a continuous short-term vision when it comes to these issues that not only doesn't solve the problem, it is the problem. It is the origin of the cycle of violence that we're experiencing. The origin goes all the way back to slavery. But it's the contemporary impetus that keeps that momentum for that machine to move forward.
And what was more troubling to me, in particular about the mandatory minimum bill, was that you heard legislators who supported this talk about how they would provide resources to these individuals once they came home. I was in a meeting where I heard Mr. Smith, the representative for the police department, talk about that they were going to make sure that they provided wraparound services for these individuals, like in a combination of passing this legislation, they were also going to provide wraparound services. And my question was, well, why can't you just draw your attention to providing the wraparound services? And if you think that after a year of being incarcerated, then once they come home, you're going to figure out a way to provide resources, then you have this all wrong. Because anybody knows that the day you are sentenced is the day you start to think about your reentry. And you should start, those community folks should start figuring out ways to get you resources. And the reality is there's literally no resources behind the walls for these individuals. Specifically, these ones who are doing a year. Like, so that was really troubling for me to say, oh, we're gonna lock them up, but then we're gonna provide them resources, as opposed to figuring out a way to provide resources before you consider locking them up.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm your host, Sean Yost. I'm in the studio with Nicole Mundell, Director of Out for Justice, as well as Lawrence Grand Prix, Director of Research for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Both groups are opposed to this proposed mandatory minimum gun law that is facing the Baltimore City Council right now. Let's cut to the chase, though, here. I would say, Nicole and Lawrence, I think you both you and your organizations have made it abundantly clear, as well as myriad other organizations and individuals have made it abundantly clear, that the law enforcement pursuits that we have implemented in Baltimore City over the last several decades have been ineffective at best and have been flat out failures at worst. But if you take the calculus that Michelle Alexander puts forward, yes, they've been great successes because they've been able to do exactly what they were designed to do. But the reality is this: we know, and I believe there's empirical evidence that bears this out, that a totally an antithetical approach, if you will, to law enforcement and crime prevention in cities like Baltimore has been shown. There have been different types of programs that have been shown to reduce violence, to reduce homicide in places like Oakland, places like Richmond, California. But isn't it just more advantageous fiscally to certain corporations and certain entities to keep doing the same thing over and over again? Mm-hmm. Because people make money by locking people up. Yeah. That's just kind of the bottom line. We've created an industry, a multi-billion dollar industry in the United States, based on locking up black and brown bodies. Mm-hmm. Lawrence, what are your thoughts?
I mean, I think that's exactly true. I do sometimes feel like there's a conspiracy theory narrative that goes through this. And that's why I think it's really important to see it as an investment. It is that the people who receive that investment then lobby to maintain the money that's coming into that coffers. But there are no private prisons in Maryland. All public. Mm. Right? So I think that changes the narrative. Yes, there's some prison labor, but that's a very small percentage of the budget. And this is a theory that's coming out. I wish I can remember the name of the book. But he argues that it's not always the mandatory minimums on drug dealing that cause our mass incarceration. It's things like this. People get freaked out in a local community. Remember, most people are in local and state jails. So federal mandatory minimums for cocaine is one thing. But most mass incarceration is local and state. So what does that mean? Locals, entities, and states pass laws when they see crime, out of a fear of crime, that increases the punishment for relatively minor infractions, like having a gun mm-hmm. near a park. And that is a huge untalked about space of why this mass incarceration boom got so big. We as a country have this weird bipolar relationship to violence where we love it. We watch it on TV every night. We consume it, but we're terrified of it. We've lived in terror of violence since the fear of the Native American raid and the slave revolt. and we have created an institution called police that we, some of us, worship. You just think about all the TV movies with cops to protect us from this deep well of violence we fear is just waiting to destroy our homes. So we need to talk about our relationship to violence, the idea that things are like, we have to do it as a community to stop violence. Cops don't do that. They never were designed to do that. But we have this mythology based upon, I think, our American militaristic history of violence, that if we just get a big enough police force, we can somehow deter individuals from doing anything. And we have this illusion of safety. Safety is something that you earn. Is it something that can be brought at the barrel of a gun? Because if I see a barrel of a gun, the thing I'm going to do is get a gun myself. Mm-hmm. We have to invest in community entities. Why isn't Erica Bridgeford fully funded with the work she's doing mm-hmm. with the on Penn North? Why isn't there an entity called the Kuji Jacalia Center that took individuals who were victims of violence at Sinai Hospital and said, you could go back out there and get killed or kill somebody, or we can take you through African rites of passage. They had to shut down because they couldn't get funded. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about solutions and people talk about there's nothing happening in community, I think that we have a very, very skewed lens on how we view what's happening in community. We don't see it on nightly news. We see the person who committed the murder.
Right.
But there's so much happening in community. We have to invest in it. Security cannot come at the barrel of a gun.
Well, I mean, one of the main narratives of this show, and it has been since we've been daily, is that there are amazing individuals and entities who have been doing vital work in our communities for generations. Mm-hmm. And those entities and individuals, for the most part, are unable to be funded adequately. And that is a result of the apparatus that has been in place for many decades that funds organizations like LBS or Out for Justice. It's inequitable, it's racist, and it has to be dismantled. And we're hoping that that can happen sooner than later. Let me take some phone calls, though. Let me go to John in Ellicott City. John, you're on First Edition. How you doing?
Yes, I strongly agree with your guest. You know, the minimum sentences, that's not the answer. But one thing you don't want to do is to dismiss the legitimate concerns of seniors and people who are living in very high crime areas. And public safety will always be the first responsibility of any government. Now, I agree it should be smart policing strategies, and you're just not throwing money at the problem. But when you see stories, the account of a 92-year-old man who was just beaten down and killed, so that's something that should not be dismissed. And I felt earlier in the show, it seemed like you're pitting one group against another, and that's not good either.
That's a fair observation. I don't think that's necessarily what was happening, but it's a fair. I get your point. I get your comment. Let me go to Gene in Pikesville next, though. Gene, you're on First Edition. How you doing?
Yep, pretty good, guys. Hope you guys are doing well. Amygdala. Are you familiar with what the amygdala is?
I am not.
And I am not either.
Okay.
On Thursday on C-SPAN, they had the Justice Department, and they were interviewing a group in Chicago, I guess it was a man who wrote a book, and he was a psychologist. And so the amygdala, I would imagine, has to do with the, condition response, endorphins, and, you know, how we get from our pleasure center and why we do things.
Okay.
And so they were talking about using an approach similar to what your guests are talking about, where they use people in a community who can diffuse situations with, you know, people who are faced with, violent situations as a solution to their problems. So, having said that, but what they're talking about is government funding, and using these groups and financing them. And he said that it was not a political approach. He suggested, well, he's a health person.
All right. Gene, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, go ahead. Finish up.
So it just seems as though the pendulum is swinging toward the solution that you guys are talking about.
Okay. Gene, thank you for your comment. You're appreciate welcome. It. Let's take one more call. Let's go to Thomas quickly in Churchville. Thomas, you're on First Edition. How you doing?
Sean, and guess how you guys doing, man?
All right, brother.
Sean, let's not forget, Martin O'Malley, just before he left office, okay, sign a bill stating that the state of Maryland would be partners with this thing called Prisons Corporations of America, which guarantee them X number of people will be locked up in the state of Maryland. Sean, this bill is on a fast track of fulfilling Martin O'Malley's dream.
And they could be sued if they don't fill certain bits.
Well, and let's also forget that Martin O'Malley was the, I was going to say something, was the father of zero tolerance policing in Baltimore City when he became mayor of Baltimore in 1999. We have still not recovered from that policing policy in our city. So there's that. Nicole Mundell, why don't you describe for us, executive director of Out for Justice, why don't you describe for us the core of your work, the work that you're doing in your organization?
So Out for Justice is a member-led organization, one of the only, if not only, maybe one or two organizations in the state that is member-led and is led by individuals with criminal records. And what we do is we teach ourselves and other community folks the legislative process from start to finish. And then we mobilize ourselves to then go to Annapolis and lead the policy reform we want to see. And so it's a very grassroots organization. I always say the members decide what we do, how we do it, and when we do it, what policy we do, what community initiatives we engage in, what type of partnerships, you know, we create. And it has been a very amazing experience thus far. I started out as just a regular member, just wanting to help, wanting to figure out a way to be a voice for women who hadn't quite found their voice yet after leaving prison or jail. And I wanted to figure out a way to combine my love for the legislative process, because I worked for Delegate Jill Carter in the past in the legislature and worked for Delegate Mary Washington. So I love the legislative process, and it's just been rewarding to work with other community folks, folks that are directly impacted by the criminal justice system and who learn about the legislative process and really use what we've learned to then go to Annapolis and educate lawmakers and community people about policy. So we've been leading policy reform in this state for quite a while. And we are folks, you know, most people don't expect individuals who've been to prison or jail to write them their own policy or even know how to advocate for themselves on the state and local level, but we do.
Understood. Lawrence Grand Prix, where are we at with this proposed legislation? Is it on its last legs, or where
well,
are we at?
Well, that's up to the city council and whether they have the fortitude to recognize what this bill now is. This bill is now essentially a codification of the status quo, with very, very minor tweaks potentially. But I think that's a waste of folks' time. So if they continue to talk about this, it's because, again, they want to be on the news. They want the PR benefit, and they could easily pass a bill that's essentially the status quo. They should have the guts to withdraw it and say, this is a waste of everyone's time. We're not going to waste our time debating a bill that is essentially the status quo. But I think, again, the larger conversation is even the public health discourse. Sometimes this public health discourse, they say violence is a disease. So does that mean that young black men are pathogens? Are they viruses? It goes beyond where I think we even have a solid language to understand. And I think it even goes into the context of, like, people shouldn't be punished for a mistake. But sometimes carrying a gun isn't a mistake. If you have to sell drugs to feed your family, you need your toolkit for your job, just like a construction worker has a hard hat. I know that could be a rough thing to say, but what I'm really saying is that the people who are forced into these situations are forced into these situations because of the years of economic and social destruction that have been wrought upon them. Mm-hmm. So would you rather have a cop talking to a young person carrying a gun or Erica Bridgeford, who is a trained person who has dedicated her life to doing this, is working out of the Children's Safe Zone in Penn North.
Yeah.
What the caller was talking about was the amygdala.
Erica Austin.
The amygdala is a part of the brain that registers threats. When people see cops, there's an innate threat response. When people see people who are not from their community, there's an innate threat response. Let's fund the people in this community to work with these individuals. That's the only solution.
Lawrence Grand Prix is Director of Research for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Lawrence, good to see you. Thank you for coming through. And Nicole Mundell is Executive Director of Out for Justice. Nicole, good to see you as well.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the second hour of First Edition is coming up. Stay tuned.
We'll be right back.